Nemoto presents American presidents. Samuel Huntington, last Continental Congress president slash first under the Articles, 1779-1781. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 7 minutes. In the late autumn of 1779, a spare, careful man from Connecticut took the chair in Philadelphia and set about the unglamorous work of keeping a rebellion orderly. Samuel Huntington did not look like a founder out of a history painting. He was the son of a farmer and miller from Windham County, apprenticed to a cooper's bench before borrowing law books and teaching himself enough to pass at the bar. He spoke without flourish, recorded things precisely, distrusted drama, and believed that the dignity of a public act lay in doing it correctly. In another age, he would have been a clerk who never misplaced a file. In the American Revolution, that quality was its own kind of courage. From September 1779 until July 1781, he presided over the Continental Congress through defeats, intrigues, empty coffers, and the final ratification of the Articles of Confederation. By the time Maryland affixed its assent and the Articles took legal effect on March 1, 1781, Huntington, still in the chair, became in practice the first President of the United States in Congress assembled. It was not a throne. It was a desk and a gavel and responsibilities that multiplied as resources shrank. His path to that desk had been steady rather than meteoric. He had served in Connecticut's Assembly on its Council of Safety, and then in Congress, where he signed the Declaration not as a famous orator but as a reliable vote and hand. He brought with him a New England instinct for committees and a Calvinist sense that paperwork, if done faithfully, is a form of duty. The body he took over needed exactly that temperament. The war had moved south, Charleston had fallen, Benedict Arnold's treason had ripped through the army's morale like a winter wind through ill-sealed boards. France was an ally which complicated everything. Foreign etiquette to observe, joint plans to draft and keep secret, jealousies to manage between officers who spoke different languages and dreamed different glories. Congress's money was a rumor, its authority outside of letters and resolutions was thinner than the paper it wrote on. Huntington's presidency was never about grand pronouncements. It was about tempo and tone. He read Washington's dispatches aloud and made sure they yielded not only size but voted instructions. When the commander-in-chief, bruised by the Conway cabal's earlier shadows and by constant wants, wrote cautiously about supplies, Huntington forced the subject into the daylight of motions, committees, and requisitions, knowing full well that half of what Congress asked of the states would be ignored. He shepherded the impost proposals meant to give the center a modest revenue by a small duty on imports, seeing that without a general fund begging would become a system. He did not harangue. He coaxed, recorded, reminded, sent another letter. In an age in love with speeches, he was the power of an agenda enforced day after day. The Western lands question gnawed at the Union like a rat at a granary door. Several large states claimed vast transappalachian territories by colonial charter. Smaller states feared a future in which the giants would grow larger still, hoarding land and rents. Maryland made its consent to the Articles conditional on a settlement. Those lands, or a good portion of them, must be ceded to the common benefit. Huntington, a New Englander whose own state faced border quarrels with New York and Pennsylvania and had seen violence in the Wyoming Valley, understood both the principle and the danger. He oversaw memorials, appointments, and a long series of communications that wore away resistance until Virginia's partial cession and other moves made Maryland's ratification possible. No one will ever write a poem about his role in those negotiations. Yet without that final signature, the Articles would have remained theory. The Union was born in part because a man who preferred order to spectacle kept asking the same question until it was answered in writing. The war pressed in on every side. In 1780, Arnold sold West Point in his mind and then tried to sell it in fact. The plot failed, but the shock carried through camp and Congress. Huntington's response was not rhetorical thunder. He managed messages to the states, soothed allies, and helped fix the idea that treason would be answered by resilience rather than purges. The same year brought Rochambeau's army to Newport, and with it the delicate work of coordination. Precedence at tables, routes on maps, shared plans that could survive both pride and weather. Huntington's signature appears on letters that seem, to a later reader, almost fussy in their attention to forms. But those forms were the bridge between a republic that had to prove its reliability and a monarchy that would not forever excuse youthful disorder. His health was never robust. The labor of chairing a legislature that tried to be a government wore him thin. Headaches and exhaustion forced him, more than once, to consider resigning. He did not bolt. He trimmed his sails, delegated where he could, and kept the minutes clean. It was his fate to be in the chair both when the articles took effect and when it became clear that no magic accompanied their birth. Congress could still not tax, could still not enforce compliance, could still be defied by any legislature that discovered a taste for local convenience over continental necessity. Huntington did not mistake paper for power. He simply believed that clear paper was the beginning of whatever power a free people could decently wield. When at last he left the presidency in July 1781, his work under the Articles complete, his endurance near its end, he returned to Connecticut and served there for the rest of his days, as lieutenant governor and then governor, an embodiment of the state's preference for steady hands over bright flames. The habits he had brought to Philadelphia he brought to Hartford. Thrift in finance, caution in innovation, a willingness to let law do its slow, equal work. He died in 1796 at his home in Norwich, buried without myth because he had not lived with any. What did he do? He made procedure into a shelter. He held Congress together through scandal and scarcity, saw the articles across the line from debate to adoption, kept allies close without fawning, kept generals informed without flattering, and made sure that the promises the United States sent into the world were spelled correctly, dated precisely, and signed by someone who meant them. What did he fail to do? He did not solve the structural weakness that would soon force a new convention. He could not make refractory states love requisitions or turn depreciating paper into bread. But to demand such things of him is to misunderstand his kind of usefulness. The revolution required, alongside its soldiers and theorists, men who could sit in a hard chair and insist that the meeting begin on time, that the letters go out today, that the record of what was done be exact. Samuel Huntington was that insistence in human form, and for a year and more, it was enough.